That was good timing. All right. The Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will begin, and we will start with Senator Kubley. Senate File 2902.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I enjoyed being personal witness to the shortest chair of the
You got to take it when you can.
Senator Kubey, I did not bounce him from here. He decided to leave.
Self-appointed, huh? Well, that might be a first, too, Mr. Chair. Anyway, today, for Senate File 2902, I have Greg Thorson with me, who has worked with a group of counties out in my area of the state. I think all of my counties except one are members of this group that is seeking to become a health care purchasing alliance. Greg Thorson works for the university, I believe. Isn't that correct? You know, I'd like to turn it over to him to explain the bill, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Thorson.
Thank you. Chairman Marty and members of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee, my name is Greg Thorson. I'm the research coordinator for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. The West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is a group of small business owners, healthcare providers, and insurance agents residing in the 12-county area of West Central Minnesota. In your committee packet, there's actually a written copy of my testimony, and Figure 1 shows you then the exact location of those 12 counties in West Central Minnesota. The mission of our purchasing alliance is to offer more affordable, high-quality health insurance options for small employers and residents in our region. We've held numerous public forums in the region and have administered hundreds of surveys to our area businesses. We are registered as a purchasing alliance with the Minnesota Department of Health, as provided for by the Minnesota Community Purchasing Act that was passed by the legislature in 1997. I have served as the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance primary research coordinator since the group's formation in 2003. My academic credentials include a BA in political science from Augsburg College in 1988 and a master's and PhD in political science from the University of California at Riverside in 1995. And since 1995, I've been employed as a political science professor at the University of Minnesota at Morris campus. However, the views that I'm expressing here today are solely mine and do not represent the views of the University of Minnesota or the Board of Regents. The bill developed by our purchasing alliance that you're looking at today and authored by Senator Kubley addresses a major problem with Minnesota Care. While Minnesota Care offers a generally comprehensive benefit set to over 120,000 subscribers, it nevertheless limits inpatient hospitalization for most subscribers to just $10,000. And Table 1 then shows to whom this $10,000 limit applies on page 3 of my testimony. Not only does Minnesota Care fail to provide adequate coverage for inpatient hospitalization, it also prohibits enrollees from having any other significant health coverage. As a result, Minnesota Care enrollees are exposed to significant financial risk. Now, I've included in my testimony tables 2 and 3 that show the average inpatient hospitalization costs of some major diagnostic categories and specific diagnoses in Minnesota for the year 2006. And my point in doing so is that you can see that it's rather commonplace for inpatient hospitalization costs to exceed $10,000. So in Table 2, you can see the fourth item listed down there. Typical burn, inpatient hospitalization for burn categories, this is data provided by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, shows that mean diagnosis in 2006 would produce about a 7.98-day mean length of stay in the hospital at a cost of $41,455. Okay, and don't forget, Minnesota Care's cap on inpatient hospitalization is just $10,000. If you flip over to table 3 on page 5, you can see some specific diagnoses and the tremendous inpatient hospitalization costs that are typical of that. A heart transplant will land you 26 days in the hospital on average with a cost of $335,000. Okay, you can see a length of typical specific diagnoses. Our point is simply that a $10,000 inpatient hospitalization cap in Minnesota Care is not adequate and leaves enrollees subject to significant financial risk. It's important to note, then, that the state is making Minnesota care available to more Minnesotans, including adults without children. Since January 1st of this year, adults without children are now eligible for Minnesota care with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty guideline. On July 1st of next year, that percent increase is scheduled to go up to 215%. So what happens if a Minnesota care enrollee has a major medical problem, such as those listed in Tables 2 and 3? For adults with children under the age of 20 or who themselves are blind or disabled, there is some help. And in the testimony I list there, a procedure called a spend down, in which they may use eligible medical expenses to reduce the calculation of their eligible income until they become eligible for the unlimited hospitalization coverage available through medical assistance. But that's very expensive for the families. It can result in they can be forced to pay the difference from qualifying from up to 275% of the federal poverty line, if they have children, down to 100% of the federal poverty line for up to, in some cases, a six-month period. A very significant amount of out-of-pocket liability for families. It gets worse for adults that do not have children who are on Minnesota care. For adults that are not blind, do not have disabilities, don't have children at the age of 21, there is no spend-down option available to them. Unless they were enrolled in general assistance medical care, hospitalization-only coverage prior to their health crisis, those Minnesota care enrollees would be personally liable for all of those inpatient hospitalization charges that exceeded $10,000. Attempts made last year to increase the hospitalization cap failed, and this year's budget deficit, of approximately $935 million severely limits the ability of the legislature to remove the cap. So our solution this year that we propose is simple. Given the fiscal constraints, given the nature of the problem, we propose that the state should modify the eligibility for Minnesota care to allow enrollees to carry a private hospitalization policy that would be used solely for the purposes of covering hospitalization charges that exceed Minnesota Care's $10,000 cap. We believe that the fact that the state has increased access to Minnesota Care, while itself very laudable, would serve nevertheless to exacerbate the problem even larger than it is now, due to the fact that many of these newly eligible enrollees will not be eligible for the GAMC hospitalization-only coverage. As a result, we believe that it is imperative that at a minimum, the state allow Minnesota Care enrollees to fill this gap in hospitalization coverage themselves by allowing them to purchase a private supplemental inpatient hospitalization policy that covers them in the event that their annual hospitalization costs exceed $10,000.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thorson, is there a minimum loss ratio requirement for this kind of policy? I mean, the way this is drafted in Chapter 256L, is there a minimum loss ratio?
In terms of that would be required out of the by the insurer for this policy?
By the state for the insurer.
You know, I looked at minimum, Mr. Chairman, I looked at some of these minimum loss policies, and I can't answer that question in terms of whether my first instinct would be to say that, you know, those minimum loss ratios, observation number one is that most fully insured partners are exceeding them significantly. And that they'd be based on business size. And the individual market would be governed by those. I don't see this as fundamentally altering that relationship in terms of minimum.
The reason I have the concern is when you have cancer insurance, and so on, there are all kinds of scam artists out there who sell you cancer insurance. It covers nothing and costs a lot. And I realize, I mean, this is in effect, I think, the first time we're doing a Minnesota Care supplemental thing, which is the direction Medicare has gone, cover less and less and put more supplements out there. But and I understand why the hospitals want this so they get paid, and how people who are on Minnesota Care want to have coverage so they don't go bankrupt for a hospitalization. So I understand all that, but how do we know that this plan isn't going to be overcharging fairly low-income people for coverage that's fairly minimal? That's what the minimum loss ratio purpose would be.
And Mr. Chair, there's nothing in the bill that would envision the requirements of minimum loss ratios to be altered by this policy. In other words, I believe a lot of those minimum loss ratios are tied to what group or what type of policy is being written, whether it's individual or small group.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, in regard to your question about loss ratios, we do have loss ratios established in the law, but for individual policies, they're pretty high on the amount of money that an insurance company can keep. Now, all insurance companies don't go with a minimum loss ratio. They have a better loss ratio, but there are many companies that don't. And, you know, I guess we did, the bill we passed out of Finance Committee yesterday does raise the hospital caps in that bill again. As far as I'm concerned, it isn't the budget is the problem. We had it in the bill last year. The governor requested that we take it out. We have money in the Minnesota Care Fund to raise the cap. It hasn't been raised for inflation since the program was created. I believe it should be raised. And, really don't. And yes, we have to balance a budget, but I guess I, for one, don't believe we should be using the Health Care Access Fund to balance the budget. Meant for general fund uses. It was meant to make sure people who have are on the program. We should be using it for.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund. And our purchasing alliance thinks those are steps in the right direction to raise the inpatient hospitalization cap. And of course, we'd prefer that the inpatient hospitalization cap was eliminated. But the budget implications are serious. As the consumers or enrollees get caught in the crossfire of this, though, what we're hearing a lot from our residents is that they simply can't expose their farm and small business assets to the low inpatient hospitalization caps. And if they could buy it, since the government can't produce the solution yet, or at least to the degree to not only raise the inpatient hospitalization cap, but to eliminate it. Even if it were raised to $15,000 or $20,000, many of these procedures far exceed that and would still expose their small business and individual assets significantly. Those assets would be exposed. So if they were allowed to purchase optionally a private supplement that would just be used solely for the purpose of taking care of the low inpatient hospitalization gap, that would at least provide a short-term remedy until longer-term breaks in the dam can happen politically.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Coogley, I'm not opposing your bill. I just want to make sure the witness had the correct facts about the situation. And, I think the other concern, however, that I would have is, you know, people are telling us that there are, you know, oftentimes circumstances where people aren't buying Minnesota care because they feel like they can't afford that premium.
20 different ones. Which one?
And so we're trying to reduce the premiums in that program to make sure more people can be signed up for it. So then the question is, if they can't afford the premiums in the Minnesota care program, how can they afford to go buy another insurance policy and be paying two premiums? And I think that's, you know, I think that's where the concern would be, but I don't know how much you think a policy like this will cost.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund. We have run some of these numbers with not through formal actuarial processes, but looking at similar products. We do have health insurance agents on our board as well as healthcare providers, and some estimates have come out as low as $30 to $50 per month per covered body. Now, there are lots of different people in Minnesota Care right now have a wide range of different personal financial conditions. And those that are going to be eligible for the spend down, those with children, I think that works okay, to be candid with you, in terms of that. It's those who are newly making eligible for Minnesota Care, saying, hey, we've got a comprehensive quality health care program for you. What we're hearing is the drawback is, yeah, but it doesn't cover it. These are people who might have income limits that are now pushing closer to the limits of Minnesota Care. Because we don't have access to affordable health care in the private market, but we can't sign up for Minnesota Care because this inpatient hospitalization cap subjects all of our assets to a very unacceptable risk for them. That's who we're hearing from. That's a lot of rural residents. And so that we see as a solution to that.
Mr. Thorson, who would be selling the policy? Who would be underwriting the policies?
Mr. Chair, and that would be, I should be very explicit here. There is no existing product that covers inpatient hospitalization only above $10,000 right now. But we would expect that it would be that there would be a newly created market and that the healthcare insurance industry is licensed to operate in the state of Minnesota would develop such a plan.
We have one person who wants to testify, one other. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the committee. And before he starts, I just want to say that I think looking at loss ratio, Senate Council thinks it's 72 or 82, depending on...
82 for the small employers,
72 for small employers and 72 for individual. I guess my initial reaction is this is a terrible thing to do, but it might be better than what we've got now. I really don't think it's great to be selling hospital-only supplemental policies, but I understand why you're doing it. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Kubley, we are neither in favor nor opposed to the bill. We just wanted to point out that we believe that what Senator Berglund just said in terms of the better solution we would say is to remove the hospital cap or to increase the hospital cap under Minnesota Care to try and solve the problem. In the event that this is a product that moves forward, we don't currently have a lot of people that are saying to us that this is something that they are very interested in, so we have not seen that movement in the market. And the last point that I would make is just to say that if you are moving forward with this, we'd ask the proponents not to come back here and mandate that we sell this type of coverage in future years. If there really is a demand for it, we will work with them to develop it. But at this point in time, we have not seen that. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Questions for Mr. Griffin. Mr. Thorson, how much are people projecting this is going to cost in a premium for family or a small business?
Mr. Chair, I think the confidence interval of what I'm saying is fairly wide, but we've heard projections based on discussions with insurers in our area and brokers in our area of somewhere between $30 to $50 per month per covered body. So a lot of times these are going to involve husband and wife with no children, with farm assets. It could be between $60 and $100 per month to just get the inpatient hospitalization coverage that exceeds $10,000. But the absence, again, as the chair pointed out, is to not have that coverage at all and to have all your assets exposed.
Further discussion from the committee. Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thanks. Mr. Chair. Motion? Senator Coring. Oh, we have an effective date change, Senate Council says. Senator Coring moves that before the period on line 25 of page 2, insert comma, or upon federal approval, comma, whichever is later. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Coring moves Senate file 2902. Senator Berglund.
I just have one other concern that I want to express, and that is that, you know, if we do go in this direction, it's going to be harder for us to get the inpatient hospital cap raised. And it's very clear to me that there will be people in the Minnesota Care program. And we have people in the Minnesota Care program who are paying $4 a month in a premium because that's all they can afford to pay based on their income. And they're not going to be able to go buy a $30 or $50 a month insurance policy. So, you know, I just have a little concern that if this is the direction we go, then people think, oh, well, the hospital cap doesn't matter. And yet, you know, the poorest people in the program will still not be getting their hospital bills paid the way they should be.
Mr. Berglund, I agree. I think this is terrible policy. I'm not sure if it's better than what we've got now. But Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, could you, just for my benefit on that hospital cap, tell me what we could do or why we haven't done it up to this point, just a capsule history on it?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dahl, we last session tried to raise a hospital cap from $10,000 to $20,000, and in conference committee, the governor's office asked us to remove it from the bill, so we did. This year we have put it in the bill again, and, you know, my own feeling is that this cap has never been adjusted for inflation. We've had this program for, I don't know, 12, 15 years. And, you know, clearly it should be raised. It should be adjusted for inflation. About 34% of the hospital charges are not paid for in the inpatient part of the Minnesota Care Program because of a hospital cap. The idea of the program was not to leave the hospitals with debt when we insure somebody. It was to make sure they didn't have debt. So I think we need to raise the cap. And, you know, if everybody in the program could afford to go buy another policy, I wouldn't think this would be a bad idea. But we have an awful lot of people in the program that, you know, all they can really do is afford to pay their Minnesota Care premium because their incomes are fairly low. And I just worry that we won't get the cap raised for the majority of the people in the program who aren't going to be able to buy another policy. And I just wanted to express that concern.
Further discussion? If not on Senator Coring's motion, this goes directly to the floor, I believe. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Division.
Division. Sorry about that.
Division has been requested. All those in favor, raise your hand.
Mr. Chair, that was the vote on the bill moving out of here, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Division. Yeah.
Yes.
All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed. Motion does not prevail.
It's too late.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
I don't think she could change it. It looked like 2-4. Thank you, though.
We will keep this in mind as we continue with the discussion about the hospital cap.
And I do think that this points to the problem we've got, and I don't think not passing this is a great solution either. Neither case is fixing it. But thank you, though, for coming. Senator Cooley, animal chiropractic.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3165 came to you from the Senate Agriculture Committee, but it deals with providing chiropractic services to the owners of animals as one option for treating those animals for a variety of problems that may or may not be able to be met by a veterinarian. We think that it's primarily outside the scope of veterinarians to provide the kind of treatment that would be provided by chiropractic care. We have a couple of witnesses with us today, Mr. Chair, and we'll turn it over to them to give you their reasons for wanting this bill to proceed.
Thank you, Senator Kubwi. Go ahead, either witness, whoever wants to start.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Hulbert, and I'm a breeder of and a handler of purebred Cairn Terriers. Those are the Toto dogs. As most breeders, my wife and I gladly spend, and on average, about $1,000 to $2,000, possibly $3,000 annually on skilled veterinary, primary, and secondary care. We plan to spend money also on open access animal chiropractic, should it be legalized, and licensed chiropractors be able to provide that. I know of each of my dogs, and I will expect to choose their care without appealing for referrals from one or more gatekeepers. A few years ago, the problem with access became evident to me when I tried to locate chiropractic care for one of my dogs with severe back pain. I was told, after I called around to several veterinarians, the only ones that can, veterinary people with training, can provide that in Minnesota, and I called around to about 10 chiropractic offices, and I was told that I could have an appointment and that my dog could have an appointment for treatment in about a month. This is unrealistic. So I'm here today in support of SF-3165, a bill to permit licensed doctors of chiropractic who have completed additional and intensive 210-hour course of study approved by the American Veterinary Chiropractic Association to provide animal chiropractic in Minnesota.
SF-3165 and its companion, HF-3584, will legalize and regulate chiropractor-provided animal chiropractic care in Minnesota. This bill is modeled after successful legislation in Oklahoma, and the letter from Oklahoma is in your packet, indicating there in the years that this open access to animal chiropractic has been in effect in Oklahoma, there have been absolutely no problems, no complaints lodged with the Board of Chiropractic. This bill also reflects the recommendations of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Animal Husbandry Working Group. Now, that Animal Husbandry Working Group included, among other professionals, one chiropractic physician and four practicing veterinarians and professors of veterinary medicine, and met for several months last summer and fall. The Animal Husbandry Working Group discussed the issue of a required veterinary referral on at least three occasions. On each occasion it was brought up, the majority opinion of the working group, supported each time by two or three veterinary professors of veterinary medicine, was still for open access of the consumer and his or her animals to animal chiropractic provided by licensed and trained chiropractic physicians. That is, care not requiring a prior visit to and depending on a referral from a veterinarian. When its work had been completed, the working group sent its recommendation to the legislature this January, again stating in its recommendation for consumers open access to animal chiropractic with clinical communication required with the animal's veterinarian. This is the working group recommendations. Modern chiropractors are trained to treat their human patients or to refer them to providers when appropriate, as members of a healthcare team. They are prepared to collaborate with veterinarians as well. This bill will promote strong working relationships between the doctors of veterinary medicine and the doctors of chiropractic. In fact, this bill before you requires that every registered animal chiropractic physician in Minnesota provide copies of clinical diagnostic and treatment notes, not just a letter, to his or her human clients upon request and to the animal patient's veterinarian. This law is the statute, proposed statute, is about involving the veterinarian in the animal's care when appropriate. This bill only deals with doctor of chiropractic's legal permission to provide chiropractic services to animals. Mr. Chairman, over 1,000 citizens from almost every district in the state have gone on record to indicate that they believe the current law needlessly restricts animals' access to safe and effective chiropractic care and obstructs an owner's right to choose preferred health care for his or her animal. Mr. Chairman, I need to emphasize that this bill will add trained and skilled animal chiropractors to Minnesota's animal health care system, not weekend wonders. Licensed chiropractic physicians have already 3 years of clinical training. The doctors who also make the commitment to successfully complete one of the 210-hour programs specified in the statute, first of all, will provide state-of-the-art animal chiropractic care.
Mr. Holbert, are you almost done? I should have said this earlier, but I want to ask all witnesses to be very concise. We want to make sure we get all the information.
Okay.
But
I'm
we
almost
have
done.
Eight bills and so on. So
okay.
Thank you.
The second thing they will do is be prepared to recognize conditions due to the training that they received in school and in the veterinary training to include, to recognize zoonotic conditions, diseases that are transferable to humans that require referral to laboratory analysis and referral to veterinary care. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, please support SF-3165 as amended. To allow licensed and registered chiropractic physicians to provide Minnesota's animal owners open access to chiropractic care. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Seafield, welcome to the committee. And I'm going to ask again, it was not meant to focus on Mr. Holbert, but for witnesses on all the coming bills, please try not to repeat testimony you've heard from others and to get the points across you need, because we are not going to finish our agenda this afternoon at the rate we're going, and we don't have a lot of time tonight. So,
well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our next witness, Ms. Seifelt, would like to reference an amendment that Senator Wergen is offering on our behalf, and so I'd like to, you know, defer to her to offer the amendment at this
Senator
time.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
And this is the one to separate the...
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to start explaining?
Explain it while it's being...
Mr. Sure. Chair, I have absolutely no problem with Senator Kubli's bill. I see this bill as one that allows me to take my dog, which is an animal, to a chiropractor if I so desire. And so I have absolutely no problem with Senator Kubli's bill. My issue is simply that if you're treating humans and animals, it should be in two separate rooms, because animals carry things like pinworm, ringworm, fleas, things like that, that are transmitted to humans. And so what my amendment does is say just simply that it has to be in a separate, non-carpeted room, which is typical of a veterinary's clinic, and so that there is no interaction in a treatment room between an animal and a human being. Thank you.
Discussion on the amendment. Ms. Seifelt, you might as well begin the testimony now then on
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Annie Seifelt. I am soon to graduate from Northwestern Health Sciences University as a doctor of chiropractic, and I am also in the animal chiropractic program at Healing Oasis in Sturtevant, Wisconsin. Also, I am founder of Minnesota Animal Chiropractic Care, which is a grassroots organization focusing on broadening access to chiropractic for Minnesota's animals, but only by specially qualified chiropractors. And in the interest of being brief, I would just like to offer my support for the amendment, Senator Wergen's amendment, stating that in order to build an appropriate doctor-patient relationship with animals, a chiropractor does need a home base in order to be reliably available for follow-up and continuing care. To this end, animal chiropractors will need to be able to see animals in the clinics in which they work. Our organization believes that the prudent approach to this would involve the maintenance of a separate adjusting room with separate equipment, as described in the amendment. In the interest of brevity, I will just make myself available to any questions at this time. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Seifelt. Senator Kubli, you have any comments, or it was your amendment you indicated, I believe.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I think the amendment is a good one. I think it needs to be separated. I think it would just put people more at ease in visiting their chiropractor if they knew they treated other species.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the Wergen amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill, Ms. Seifelt, did you have any other comments on the bill?
I think Dr. Hulbert did a very good job of covering it. I wanted to state that the state of Oklahoma there's a letter included in your packet that states that there have been no challenges to the existing statute and rule, and there are no known lawsuits on file against any board-registered animal chiropractic practitioner in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma is the model that we modeled our bill after. And we took that model and we added the recommendations of the Animal Husbandry Working Group in order to move those forward into law. And also the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners, you also have a letter of no objection from them and their indication of willingness to promulgate relevant rules and work with the Minnesota Veterinary Board to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask Dr. Hulbert, is there anything in the law today that would prohibit me, if I own a dog, from taking someone who represented themselves as a chiropractor and had that dog treated by that person? Is there anything that would prohibit me from doing that?
I can't take one of my dogs to a Minnesota licensed chiropractor and ask that chiropractor to practice animal chiropractic on my dog. Was that what you're asking?
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Hulbert, no, not exactly. I guess what I'm trying to get at is licensing someone to be a doctor of animal chiropractic essential to get whatever treatment I may want for my dog if I could find someone who would provide it, whether or not they had the designation licensed animal chiropractor or not? Is there anything that would prohibit me from, say I had a neighbor who was a chiropractor and said that he could do an adjustment on my dog and I wanted that done and I could take it to him and pay him
$20? I think the legality of the current statute requires that the dog be taken to a veterinarian only.
And Mr. Chairman? And Dr. Holbert, I'd be curious to know that. I don't think there's anything in law that requires you to take your dog to a veterinarian for any purpose, is there?
I know that a chiropractor cannot practice on an animal in Minnesota right now.
Okay, is that, Mr. Chairman, I guess that's what I was trying to get at. If we have a law that prohibits someone from, but I'm struggling with that because if I say I'm a chiropractor and I'm not licensed, I guess I'm, but I don't practice anything but on cats, let's say, am I violating the law? If I say I'm a chiropractor that only practices on cats, even though I'm not licensed, am I in violation of the law? Does anybody, can counsel answer that?
We'll ask her to take a look at it. Senator Johnson.
To Mr. Chairman and to Senator Hahn's point, I have many chiropractic friends that do adjust animals. And if I ask them to, they would adjust mine. So I'm curious, too, as to the law of it. And my question to Senator Kubley and to the doctor is, to me, this kind of lowers the standard of chiropractic. I know you don't see it that way because you've added the additional education onto your licensure, but I really would like to hear from a chiropractor and see how, I mean, you've got letters in the packet saying that they're okay with this, but I think it kind of lowers the standard of chiropractic on humans.
Ms. Seafeld, I believe, is a chiropractor.
No, in 2 weeks I'll be a chiropractor. I'm a chiropractic student. I believe I can respond to the question on the floor, Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson. The way that the chiropractic statute is currently written, it says adjustment of the word human is
Mr.
in the
Chair.
Statute.
Could I ask the speaker to pull the microphone a little
closer? It's hard to hear.
I'm very sorry. Thank you. The way that the current chiropractic statute is written, the word human is in the statute. The educational requirements that are written into this bill work to maintain the standard of care that would be provided by an animal chiropractor. Our organization was against simply removing the word human from the statute so that a chiropractor who had not taken this additional training would be able to provide services to animals. We firmly believe that there is additional training that a doctor would need to take in order to be truly qualified to provide services to an animal. So the recommendations of the Animal Husbandry Working Group, our organization feels we're very responsible in maintaining the quality of care that will be provided to animals in Minnesota.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But to Senator Hahn's point, is it actually illegal for my friends that are chiropractors to be adjusting their dogs and mine?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, they are putting their licensure at risk by doing so.
Ms. Seafeld, I presume that's if they're doing it for compensation.
That's my understanding.
If they're just doing it because they're a neighbor and they want to help, I presume they can do that.
If you're adjusting a friend's dog, that's at your own discretion.
Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess to that point, I'm trying to clarify that. If I'm not trained as a chiropractor, I'm not licensed as a chiropractor, but I tell people I'm an animal chiropractor and then do adjustments on people who willingly pay me money to do that, am I violating the law? I mean, I'm not licensed. I don't have any kind of obligation to or code or anything I'm putting my license in jeopardy of. It seems to me that if you've got a willing buyer and a willing seller and they want to, maybe they want to do a rain dance around the dog and they claim that will help or I don't know. I'm not trying to be facetious here, but I'm just trying to understand if there's a restriction between anybody who claims to offer a service to an animal, it isn't harming it, it isn't causing it any harm or hurt, is that kind of transaction prohibited, no matter what it might be, whether it's called animal chiropractic or anything else?
Senator Hahn, Senate Counsel is looking at the definition of chiropractic, and because it refers to the human body, perhaps it is conceivable you could be calling yourself an animal chiropractor. Yeah. But
Mr. Chair, you have to be licensed to practice chiropractic in this state, and under the definition, that is doing articulations of the human body. Doesn't say you can't do it on animals.
Yeah.
So you have to be licensed to be doing this on a human body. I don't know necessarily if you have to be licensed to be doing the articulations on a non-human body, yeah, unless you've got the veterinarian statute that might limit that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Ms. Seifel.
Thank you. The veterinary statute does list in its titles section that someone must be a veterinarian in order to refer to themselves as an animal chiropractor.
Okay, that could be.
Senator Hand.
Well, and maybe that's the problem, I guess, is I'm a little troubled by trying to create another licensed practice called animal chiropractic. And I'm certainly willing to let people have discretion to choose who they want to treat their animals, and I think we should give them some discretion to use their judgment to do that as long as they're not abusing or harming the animal. But I'm not sure that this may not cause some additional problems that we may not want to try to address, which is creating this whole other practice and trying to differentiate it from human chiropractic. And then we've got these issues with the veterinarians, which I think are legitimate, that they are trying to preserve a medical standard that, I don't know, I'm just sort of, we had this up in our agriculture committee yesterday, and we spent a lengthy amount of time discussing this, and maybe we need to do that again to really understand it. But
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cooley, I'm a little confused about this. In subdivision, in section 4, line 214, we are, after all of this, we're creating the animal chiropractor practitioner. Do you have veterinarians? Do veterinarians have this line of practice as well? And how are they different? So if I have problems with my dog and I go to my veterinarian, they will be able to do this, correct? They will be able to treat my dog if I ask. So why, my question is, are we giving some kind of a practice, kind of the authority to do a different scope of practice with animals? And what would be the reason we are creating these two, since we do have, if we do have veterinarians who already do this? I'm just concerned about why are we creating something or a group that will be competing with that practice? Because they will have to be licensed, and it's really a whole new thing. Is it because we need this? Is there a need out there?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, veterinarians are not traditionally trained to do chiropractic on animals. In fact, the vast majority of them, well over 95%, do not practice chiropractic care, nor are they trained to recognize a need for chiropractic care in animals. And so it seems to me that it makes sense to have another category. You know, I think the veterinarians argued in the Ag Committee that they needed a referral from a veterinarian, which adds to your cost, of course. But I think the average owner recognizes the kind of need that their animal needs and can seek the appropriate kind of care. But the average veterinarian probably would not see any need for chiropractic care because they haven't been trained to recognize maladies that exist that need that kind of treatment.
Senator Kubli, but my question is, why are we taking, I guess my inclination would be to think that that this is something that veterinarians should do because this is their line of practice, but we are now moving into giving chiropractors this line of practice and creating kind of a new thing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
so we need
Senator
to do that.
Torres-Ray, it is not the normal practice of veterinarians to do chiropractic care. That's not one of the areas they deal with. They you know, they can go to additional training to give them that kind of expertise, but they do not traditionally have it in graduating from a school of veterinary science. Perhaps Ms. Seafeld,
I understand that, Senator Cooley. Mr. Chair, if I may, I don't argue that, but my argument is, I'm just trying to make sense out of this. If this is something that is needed, if this is the kind of treatment that is needed, doesn't it make sense to you that veterinarians should do it? Because I'm thinking, why would chiropractors get into veterinarian practice? If this is something that is needed, I'm pretty sure that veterinarians will get the training to get it done because the market requires that. So why are we giving this to another type of practitioner?
Senator Worgen, on that point.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Senator Torres-Ray, it's sort of like the human. You can go to the doctor and they can do certain things, and a doctor can be a doctor, a medical doctor, and a doctor of chiropractic at the same time. But there's a significant difference between the cost of an office visit to the medical doctor, who is also a chiropractor, versus simply going to the chiropractor for a neck adjustment. This would allow, basically, it's another practice that they cannot do nearly all what a veterinarian can, but it's probably a whole lot less costly to take my dog to an animal chiropractic simply for a back adjustment as opposed to going to the veterinarian for a back adjustment for my dog.
It's probably a cost and access issue.
I see. Thank
Ms.
you.
Ms. Seafeld.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, speaking to your question, the animal chiropractic training has been available to veterinarians and chiropractors for about 20 years. Less than 30 of Minnesota's veterinarians have taken the postgraduate training in animal chiropractic that's approved by the American Veterinary Chiropractic Association. The reason that we are coming here today is because it is a public access issue. There's an estimated almost 3 million animals, dogs, cats, and horses in Minnesota. With less than 30 veterinarians who have taken the postgraduate training and therefore are qualified to provide chiropractic services to animals, that's about 97,000 animals per qualified veterinarian in the state today. So the public access issue is why we're here, and which is evidenced by we have almost 1,000 emails, letters, and signatures on petition wanting this access broadened. The chiropractic school has an active student group with at least 30 members at any given time. There's a strong interest among the chiropractic community to become specially qualified and be able to provide this much needed service. Thank
Just
you.
Just a follow-up question,
Senator
Mr. Chairman.
Torres-Ray.
It will be, for me, if I want to take my dog to you, it will cost me less than it will cost me to take my dog to a veterinarian that actually does chiropractic.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, as far as the cost, I wouldn't be able to tell you what a veterinarian would charge for an exam and chiropractic adjustment, and, you know, as far as costing less, the way that the cost issue is if someone needs to bring their animal to a veterinarian first, have an examination, and then eventually get a referral to a chiropractor, it shouldn't really be assumed that the individual will take their animal to the veterinarian and immediately get a referral to a chiropractor if that's what's needed. There may be blood tests, x-rays, that sort of thing that are opted for first, which would increase the cost to the consumer before they can get the referral that they're asking for to the chiropractor.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I guess Mr. Holbert mentioned in his testimony that he has sought chiropractic care from a veterinarian and has had to wait a month in order to get the animal in. Well, if your animal is suffering from something that could be corrected by chiropractic treatment, you don't want to wait that long. In addition, I would mention that, you know, if you were to visit animal chiropractors who live over the Minnesota state line to the east, you would discover that they are swamped with Minnesota customers, primarily because we don't have the people available in this state who offer the same services.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Kubley.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to prolong this because I believe this is a very good bill, and I want to commend Senator Kubley for, you know, I've heard it. I heard this bill yesterday. I've heard it here today. Senator Wergen had some concerns yesterday. As you can see, that concern has been taken care of today. And I see nothing wrong with this bill, and I hope that we move forward with this bill. Mr. Chairman, could I inquire if all the people that wanted to testify have testified?
No, Senator Coring, they have not, and I think if you want to move the bill now, we should have at least the opposition witness testify
right,
first.
Right, because I'm about ready to move it, right. Because I think this bill has been vetted in the Senate very much so. So if we could hear from the opponent, and then, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the bill out of here.
Senator Coring, okay, we will, Dr. Robert Washabaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Johnson.
To Senator Coring's point, Senator Coring, this is the first time I ever heard of this bill, and I'd like to hear a lot more about it before I vote on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that's fine. We can stay here as long as you want. I can stay here as long as you want. I'm just trying to facilitate moving things forward. We have a lot of bills on the agenda, so I'm sorry I suggested that.
No. Senator Coring, I think it's appropriate to suggest it, but I think there are clearly some people here who want to discuss it more. Welcome to the committee. I don't know who wants to go first.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, and members of the Senate Health Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on the proposed legislation today. I'm Robert Washabaugh. I'm a veterinarian. I've been in practice for 26 years. I'm employed by the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota, and I hold the appointments of Professor of Medicine, Chairman of the Department of Veterinary Clinical Sciences, and Director of the Comparative Medicine Center there. And I'm the person ultimately responsible for the service, teaching, and research functions at the college. As with one of your earlier presenters, I'll just quickly cite my credentials. I took a BS undergraduate degree from Ohio State University, my veterinary degree, University of Pennsylvania, my PhD, University of Pennsylvania, board certification in internal medicine, and I'm licensed to practice in the states of Minnesota and Pennsylvania. During my career, I've taught over 2,000 veterinarians at the University of Pennsylvania and about 500 here in the state of Minnesota since moving here in 2004. You should have copies of my testimony at this point, so I'll go through some bullet points, and out of deference to the chair, I know you want to have me be succinct, and I'll try to do just that for you. My testimony is on behalf of myself and my status at the University of Pennsylvania, but as you also see, I'm also speaking on behalf of Dr. Trevor Ames, our current interim dean at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. David Lee, who is our hospital director in the Veterinary Medical Center, who was here yesterday at the meeting of the Agricultural Committee, could not attend today. So I would like to raise several issues and perhaps provide some additional perspective based on testimony I've heard here today, the first of which is quality of care. Our students, just as students who apply to and matriculate in chiropractic, are very sophisticated students. They're selected amongst really high-achieving students in the state of Minnesota. They're evaluated based on grades, GRE scores, letters of recommendation, and interviews. They spend 4 years in an undergraduate curriculum where they study things like biology, genetics, biochemistry, molecular biology. They really define the science of animal biology. And then they apply to, and they succeed in being matriculated into the school. They spend 4 years, so 4 years of college, 4 years of veterinary education, the final year of which, the eighth year, is in fact a clinical year where they see clinical cases, all animal species, horses, cows, pigs, sheep, goats, dogs, and cats. And they see these under the supervision of board-certified clinicians. They learn about important species differences between these animals. Okay, so the neuroanatomy, the neurophysiology, the diseases of the horse, they're different from what they are in the cow, different yet again from what they are in the pig, different yet again from what they are in cats and dogs. Many of these graduates, about 40%, in fact, 40% of our graduates go on to an additional 1 to 3 years of internship or residency training, so that at the end of their education, they've invested 8 to 10 years of a really solid scholarly academic program. Chiropractic students, to compare and contrast, study, and if I may emphasize, human anatomy. They study human physiology. They study human neurology. And they have an educational basis for performing chiropractic medicine on humans. I would say, however, that a 210-hour course, which is a five-week course, a short course, if you will, on veterinary chiropractic, inserted into what is otherwise a greater than 99% human curriculum, is vastly insufficient when you compare and contrast to provide the expertise to diagnose conditions in veterinary species. 4 to 5 weeks in training of veterinary chiropractic just can't even begin to compare to what is an established standard of 8 to 10 years of education in veterinary medicine. This would be akin to veterinarians being able to take a five-week short course on human anatomy, human physiology, and then stating that they, in fact, could practice human medicine at the end of that five-week short course. That's not acceptable. That is not today's standard. And I would submit that there would be no member of the committee today that would seek a veterinarian who had done a five-week short course in human medicine, human disease, human diagnosis. There is, in addition to the general question of inability to recognize species differences in diseases, diagnosis of, and treatment of, there's also the uninvestigated question of zoonotic disease, infectious and zoonotic disease. Their infectious diseases can, in fact, be transmitted from animals to humans. I would submit that, again, a five-week short course would not prepare a valid, well-established human chiropractic practitioner from diagnosing those diseases in animals. It just won't be the case. So I would ask, I suppose, rhetorically to the committee, would you consider yourself going to see a veterinarian who, in fact, had performed a five-week short course in human medicine? Would you see that person? Would you, in fact, board an airline, a Northwest airline, in which you had learned that the pilot of your plane had taken a five-week computer short course on flying the airplane? I would submit that the answer would be no. The advocates of the bill are promoting chiropractic medicine as a cheap alternative. That term has come up as an alternative. And if argued as an alternative, it's an alternative that has no established comparable efficacy or safety to veterinary medicine. It just doesn't exist. Neither side, neither veterinarians nor chiropractors, question the benefits of chiropractic care as a complementary modality. And so I think many veterinarians, while opposed to this piece of legislation, would nonetheless agree with the argument that perhaps a veterinarian would see the animal with its clinical signs and with the 8 to 10 years experience, not the five-week short course, would be able to differentiate the disease and then be the referral point to a human chiropractor who has then some animal experience. I would submit to the committee and you, Mr. Chairman, that American pet owners and the Minnesota pet owners are not looking for lower standards of care. And in fact, the bulk of the evidence in the United States today and in the state of Minnesota suggests that American pet owners are looking for greater standards of care. That has been substantiated by the American Veterinary Medical Association. It's also been substantiated by everyone in this room who owns a pet animal. American pet owners, Minnesota pet owners, are increasingly human-animal bonded. When I think of growing up in the United States in the late 50s and early 1960s, the concept of and the definition of the family dog was a dog that was tethered up to a cyclone fence in the backyard. Over 30 years, that dog has moved inside the house, it's gone upstairs, it's gone into the bedroom, it's gone onto the bed, and it's under the bed sheets. And so I heard in committee yesterday that pets are truly chattel. And in fact, they are by legal definition, and that anything whimsically can be done with these animals. But that is in defiance, if you will, of the increasingly human-animal bonded concept that is now prevalent in these United States. Let me cite a brief example. One I'll cite is one of the diseases that we see, one which could potentially come under the purview of chiropractors. One of the diseases that we see is the equivalent of the anterior cruciate ligament injury in humans. So if you're aware of athletes, they rupture a cruciate, it's called an ACL injury. We see the same thing in the domestic dog. We see a lot of it. And I would ask you if you had any idea how much American pet owners spend on this single disease and this single species in the United States in 1 year's time. I won't put you on the spot. I will tell you that, in fact, in the year 2003, just 4 years ago, American pet owners spent $1.3 billion on cranial or anterior cruciate ligament injury in dogs, the same lesion that people have. So now one may look at that and say, well, geez, aren't veterinarians expensive? And that may be the case, but every pet owner has the opportunity. A pet owner can say, yes, I will adopt this therapy or not. Americans have argued with their pocketbooks for increasing standards, not lower standards. With regard to the Oklahoma bill and the Oklahoma model, I would actually perhaps turn that on its head and say that it's one example out of 50 states and that the other 49 states, in fact, have not moved in that direction. And I think that's a persuasive argument. My remaining comments, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, are all about consumer advocacy and then the finances and the resources associated with. The advocates of this bill want to make chiropractic care directly accessible to animal owners to allow consumers to have a choice. Professional boards license their professionals, and they are the advocates for consumers of those professions. Question in my mind is who on the board of chiropractic medicine would be sufficiently trained and experienced to investigate possible malpractice by its members? That is unclear. It is unstated in this proposed legislation. The animal chiropractic credential is being proposed as a certification, not as a license. There's a clear difference and a different level of accountability. I would submit that consumers of animal chiropractic care would be entirely unprotected in an age when American pet owners have asked for not less but greater standards of care. The amendment requiring animal chiropractors to notify a client's veterinarian after treatment is insufficient. There is no guarantee that a letter would originate or would go on to. The pet owner, him or herself, might in fact say, I don't want you to send a letter to my veterinarian, if there even were a veterinarian. So what I would say in closing, Mr. Chairman, is you have not heard from me today stating disrespect or disparagement of the noble profession of chiropractic. It has a place. I respect it. The programs that are out there are all about, 99.99% or greater, about one species, namely the human. And a short course of 210 hours, when veterinarians spend 8 to 10 years mastering all of the disciplines, sub-disciplines across seven animal species, there's not a legitimate or fair question. So this for me, Mr. Chairman, is all about being consistent with the American pet owner, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and promoting the best of standards and not lowering them. I'll be happy to take questions and comments.
Questions from the committee. Senator Wergen and Senator Erickson Hopes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Doctor, there have been very few spaces of time in my life when I haven't had animals. Growing up on a farm, and you're right, on the farm, Max, our German Shepherd, was not allowed in the house, I'm here to tell you. Mm-hmm. However, our little Schnauzer, he slept in our bed. You're right. I mean, it's changed drastically. I would never deny that. But you made the analogy of would we get on an airplane where a pilot has not been trained a certain number of hours and whatever the case might be. No, I wouldn't. But here's another analogy. I would never, ever put my child in a portable kennel and check it into the cargo department of an airplane either. That's because there's a distinction between animals and humans. As much as I love my dog, it's still my dog. There's still a different standard than there is for humans. And so to that analogy, I just wanted to say, you know, I wouldn't treat my child in some of those ways that I would do with an animal either. And I just want us to keep in perspective that we are talking about dogs and cats and not children. And I value chiropractic services. As I mentioned in Ag Committee, I go to the chiropractor every week, and I'm still having trouble picturing the German Shepherd on the table getting its back adjusted, but that's life. So I want pet owners to have this access, but as I said in Ag Committee, this is still about the fact that I own a dog, the dog is an animal, and if I want to take my dog to an animal chiropractic that's not a full-fledged veterinarian, I think that ought to be my choice with my animal and my money. That's where I just come from.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, and Senator Wergen said it very well, but just to clarify again for Doctor, and I can't remember your last name.
Washaba. Not an easy one to pronounce. Thank you.
Thank you. You were reflecting on veterinarians' 8 to 10 years of foundational practice. But once they graduate and they're a licensed veterinarian, is it true that they cannot practice animal chiropractic?
No, I know of no law that prevents a graduate licensed veterinarian from practicing that if he or she wants to. I'm unaware of any law that prevents them. There are an increasing numbers of veterinarians who, in fact, see the value in. We have at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine a course, a classroom course entitled Complementary and Alternative Medicine, in which chiropractic is taught. It's not taught as a 5-week short course, but it is there nonetheless. We have veterinarians, in fact, so yesterday in Agricultural Committee, we had in attendance and in testimony Dr. Pierce Fleming, who is both veterinarian and veterinary chiropractor, who I found very morally suasively stated that, as both of those, he felt it compelling that he should see that case first as a veterinarian, and then and only then refer on to. And I think that's where veterinarians are with this, if I may give an example. The back pain that for which you and I have that we see a chiropractor, our chiropractor will go through a list of differential diagnoses and will do a subluxation. In the dog, for example, that back pain could be bone cancer, it could be osteomyelitis, it could be thrombosis, it could be intervertebral disc disease. The list is about 7 to 10 deep, only one of which would actually benefit from a subluxation. And it's the veterinarian who has 8 to 10 years of education and experience and knows the differences between the spinal innervation of these areas that will be able to differentiate that. I would have grave concern that someone who's a very good human chiropractor with 210 hours of education is going to be able to differentiate those illnesses. Subluxation in 9 of those 10, very deleterious to the health of that animal.
Senator Johnson, then Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, we're going to have to ask you a question. Would you take your 10-year-old ill child to a chiropractor before it was referred by MD? And secondfold, would you see a chiropractor who's treating a dog in the next room?
I think those are more rhetorical questions unless Senator...
Mr. Chairman, I'm serious.
I understand they're serious.
Take an ill 10-year-old child to a chiropractor without seeing an MD first?
Mr. Chair, I don't mind answering that at all. Senator Johnson, yes, I would. I went to a chiropractor without a medical referral first myself. And as a matter of fact, yes, I definitely would. I have found that to be very beneficial, and I don't have a problem with it. However, if my child were running a fever, if my child had a runny nose, there are certain things I would say go to the medical doctor first, but there are circumstances by which, by all means, I would take my child to the chiropractor without the medical doctor. And your second question, Senator Johnson, personally, no, I don't think I would go to a chiropractor that were treating animals in the same facility. But I, at the very least, wanted a separate room, which is why I offered that amendment.
Sir Han, before I call on you, I understand you were working with Senate Counsel and learned that you can't use the name animal chiropractor, animal acupuncturist, and you point out you could use animal massage therapist?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the law is silent on that, so I presume it's permissible to do that. Professor, I wanted to, in the spirit of trying to effect a compromise here, I guess, because we did hear this in agriculture yesterday, and I certainly understand the virtue for a medical profession such as a veterinary profession to say we don't want people to be confused with what we're doing, with anything else that may be done, and we want to try to make sure the public is aware that when they see a veterinarian that they are seeing a person with certain skills and training, and I appreciate that. On the other hand, people take their dogs to do all kinds of things, grooming, clipping, training, who knows, maybe they do massage therapy, I don't know. And I'm reluctant to say people don't have the right to do that and pay somebody for whatever service they want if they think it's in their interest. I'm just wondering if we change the law that says that only a veterinarian can call himself an animal chiropractor and just made the law silent on that, would that be sufficient from the standpoint of veterinarians, saying we're only going to have one licensed profession dealing with animals, and that's a veterinarian. Other than that, if people want to call themselves a chiropractor for cats, there's no license, and the public is at risk to determine whether or not they want to do that. Would something along that line be considered a compromised position from your point of view?
Senator Hahn, thank you for that question. In the spirit of levity, let's also refer to the psychics on the West Coast who believe that they communicate with all things cerebral. So there's a litany of things. Some of them come under the rubric of complementary alternative medicines. Some are grooming. There are truly some who think they communicate via extrasensory perception. So I'm posing that as kind of a levity response. But in the spirit of compromise, to use your language, the spirit of compromise for me, and I believe, perhaps with few exceptions, all veterinarians in the state of Minnesota, and certainly those in the employ of the University of Minnesota, the spirit of compromise is to not adopt this piece of legislation, but to think about a relationship whereby a pet, an animal owned by a pet owner of the state of Minnesota, is first seen by a veterinarian so that there is a true diagnosis rendered and that the animal is then, in appropriate circumstances, referred on to a chiropractor. I think that's the spirit of compromise.
And Mr. Chairman and Doctor, I appreciate that, although I think if to take your position, then one would also have to say that if I wanted to take my dog to the animal psychic, I should get a veterinarian referral, or if I want to take my dog to the person who called themselves an animal massage therapist, I should do the same. And there's a certain part of this that I get the point of saying, well, how much of this is just protecting the profession from competition?
That's fair.
And so what I'm suggesting is if we change the current law and deleted that phrase that said only veterinarians can call themselves animal chiropractors and then set aside this bill, would both sides be happy with that? And that would sort of leave that question about who's an animal chiropractor open. There would be no licensure. And if the public wanted to bring someone to someone who called themselves that, they would do so, recognizing that they're not licensed and they're not part of a medical profession. And maybe Senator Kubla, you would want to respond to.
Well, you know, Ms. Chair and Senator Hahn, I'm not sure that I think there are great distinctions among species. Dr. Washaba talked about the distinctions between species, but I don't think anybody around the table would equate seeking treatment for themselves with seeking treatment for an animal that they owned. Animals are owned. Children are not. It just seems to me that there is a considerable distance between seeking treatment for a family member or seeking treatment for your pet or your livestock. I mean, and frankly, I guess to me, it's just a matter of opinion for the individual owner. You know, the owner shouldn't feel obligated to go to a veterinarian who, by Dr. Washaba's own admission, does not have any training in chiropractic care.
I didn't say that.
Well, there are over 95% of the veterinarians in Minnesota who have had no training in chiropractic care. And he mentioned that, you can take a course at the veterinary school, which, seems to me that it might be 210 hours or it might be less, so thereby he negates his own argument by saying that a veterinarian can take a number of hours that maybe more, maybe less, maybe the same as the 210 hours that we're requiring. It doesn't seem to me that he's made an argument that really holds up under the reality of the way we view animals as to the way we view human life. And so from my perspective, I don't think that we need to move in his direction. We've passed through other committees, and I realize all committees have their own makeup and their own ability to make judgments on that. But from my perspective, I think an individual animal owner should be able to decide whether or not they want to seek chiropractic or veterinary care. And that should be up to the owner of the animal, not up to their physician.
Mr. Chair.
I want to tell people in the audience who are here for either the Lori bills or the Salzman bill, we're going to have to take them up in the evening. We are going to run out of time on that. And we do have one more witness who wanted to testify in opposition to this. Several questions. And Senator Wergen has a technical amendment, I believe, to the bill, the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do. I have the A4 amendment, which council says has to be in the bill in order to make it work well.
Is there a discussion of the amendment? It simply is cross-reference in the veterinary medicine section to allow it.
It cross-references the statutes. That's correct.
Discussion on the amendment, Senator Gorey?
I mean, if you just read the beginning of the sentence and then this, it doesn't seem to make sense to me. No provision of this chapter shall be construed to prohibit, then J, a licensed chiropractor to registered to practice animal chiropractic under sections.
In other words,
from doing what? I mean,
from
it's not
practicing
prohibiting
animal chiropractic.
Oh, from
licensed. I mean, don't we need to say from right. practicing or something like that? I mean, I don't see a prohibition here.
Registered to practice.
To practice. From practicing under sections 148.
Registered to practice animal. Right.
From practicing under. We'll get that technical amendment to the technical amendment. Senator Higgins, and then maybe we, and Senator Fischbach, then the last witness.
Well, yeah. Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment on Senator Hand's suggestion that we just remove all references from statute to animal chiropractic. And I just think that's delaying the inevitable. If there's no reference to it at all, somebody will practice and somebody will do something wrong, and then we'll all be back here with pretty much Senator Kubley's bill, and then we're going to try to fix it after the fact. I would prefer to set in place some standards now so that the harm of an animal doesn't happen when we can prevent it.
Senator Kubley, on the technical amendment, Senator Lori, maybe you could offer the following amendment to that.
Did that make sense?
Senator Counsel, will you read it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on line 35 of page 1, if we delete to practice animal chiropractic and then put that on line 36 before the period, so it would read a licensed chiropractor registered under sections 148.01 to 148.10 from practicing license registered under does that work?
Yeah, would work.
From practicing animal chiropractic. So nothing would be prohibited. Yeah, that would work.
So read the sentence as it would be.
A licensed chiropractor registered under sections 148.01 to 148.10 from practicing animal chiropractic.
Senator Lori moves the amendment to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the Wergen technical amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Now can I move the bill?
We've got one more witness who wants to answer. Senator Fischbach.
And Mr. Chair, and pretty much anyone who would like to answer this, I'm throwing this out here. Are there any other licensed professions that practice on both humans and animals? I mean, I guess I've just been kind of sitting here soaking this in, wondering if that's...
Senator, there are... I have, in my last institution as a faculty member there, did some gastrointestinal endoscopies with some physician colleagues of mine from the medical school at the Philadelphia Zoo. We would do cheetah GI endoscopy together, cheetah dentistry together. There are some examples like that for which the anatomy is different enough that you'd like to bring a group together. But that's the only example that I can think of.
Is that Becky?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, because as I'm sitting here thinking about it, and the question was asked if you would go to a chiropractor that was practicing on an animal in the next room, and I personally could not because my allergies are so bad that I couldn't be in the building in a lot of cases. And neither could you. So I was, but as I was pondering, that's what I was thinking of, if there was other.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that we've got a first here in this committee. Two Senator Lorys in here all at one time.
Ooh.
And we are so proud to see her.
I wish you all, but I always call Tony. Mr. Chairman, may I speak?
You may. You are speaking. Senator Lory, you are speaking.
I always say, and you guys will all, you'll grab this right away. That Tony is the new improved model from Senate District 8 because he gets bullshit much quicker than I ever did. And because he can say the very same same thing that it takes me 10 sentences and 2 sentences.
I can attest to that, Mr. Chair. I took over Senator Lori's spot on the Emergency Medical Services Board, and she told them that I didn't talk nearly as much as she did, and I said, well, members of the board, there isn't anyone else in the Senate who speaks as often as Senator Lori either.
Well, we miss you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. I miss you guys. I really miss you guys.
Senator Johnson, and then we'll get to the last witness.
Okay, goodbye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I just want to say that I think this makes more sense in a veterinary bill than a human chiropractic bill. I think requiring 210 hours of them just makes more sense. I just have to say that.
Sir, you were wishing to testify with concerns about the bill as well?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I just had one more comment before the next witness, if I could. You know, I guess, I was reminded again that physical therapists do operate with both species, and they are sometimes hired by veterinarians to provide that kind of care within their office.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair,
Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, so are they licensed in a physical therapist who works on both a human and an animal?
That's my understanding.
They are registered or licensed that way, so they do have additional training. I guess that was just as a follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask, in attendance today is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. John King, who I think can pass judgment on this question. May I invite him briefly to just step forward?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to digress, but it was just something, and we should maybe let the gentleman testify.
Okay, we'll let him testify, and if the board wants to speak very briefly. Go ahead.
Senator Marty and members of the committee, my name is Stan Hild. I'm a veterinarian, and briefly, my career has spanned from some time in academia through mixed practice in a multi-veterinarian practice in Buffalo, Minnesota. I feel a little bit today like the person that came to speak about water, and he had to follow Noah on the testimony. Dr. Washabaugh has given a very accurate, persuasive overview of the present issue, and there are only a few things, and I will assure you, Senator Marty, that this will be quite brief. I'm proud of my profession and as it stands, and of the organized bodies that govern the code of ethics for that profession. They have been a moving profession. They have moved along over the years and followed all of the progress that's been made, and I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of the reputation that's held by the veterinarians, and not only in grassroots society and in urban settings, but in the government's circles as well. There are some concerns I have with the present bill, and I would like to make these very brief and try to emphasize them. The bill, if passed, I feel will start a cascade of layers of regulation, including but not limited to education required, continuing education required, licensure, and another board or two. And these things translate into state regulation and taxpayers' expenses. So I think this bill is premature. And I would like to speak just briefly to the amendment on sites where someone is doing chiropractic in the same facility that there are animals being treated. I'd just like to refer to some of you that are aware of the major changes that have taken place in biosecurity in veterinary medicine and in agriculture. If you drive through the country and you see the large operations of swine enterprises, cattle enterprises, you won't be able to walk into that enterprise without taking a shower, changing clothes, going in and doing what you need to do, your visitor, whatever it is, and coming out and re-showering and changing clothes again before you go into a similar place in another place. there is definitely an issue on zoonoses that are transmissible from animals to man, and I don't think that this bill is going to deal with that. I think that the other issue that I would like to bring up is it's very clear, unclear and muddy to me in a service that has the potential of doing harm to the patient. Who is the person that's responsible for that harm? Is it the veterinarian? Is it the chiropractor? This has not been settled anyplace, but it will eventually be settled by the legal profession, I'm sure. Veterinarians have been very, very cognizant of a need to carry professional liability insurance. I don't know if chiropractors are going to be able to get anyone that will carry them with liability insurance if they're working on animals. And this is another issue that hasn't been brought up, and I would like to see it discussed before a bill like this is passed. Those are the only issues. I would like to just second the things that Dr. Washabaugh has said, and seriously, it's veterinary medicine, chiropractic 101 in just a few minutes, and he's done an excellent job.
Thank you,
Dr.
Hill.
I would entertain any questions if you have.
Thank you. And Senator Fischbach was the one who had the question for the board, but if you could give the answer, we'll make sure she hears it if she's not. She is back here. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. And
Chairman, Senator Marty, and members of the committee, my name is Dr. John King. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, familiar with the veterinary statutes and rules, and also have had interactions with the chiropractic statutes and rules. This bill particular is addressing scope of practice issues for chiropractors, and that's the bottom line. And it's a policy decision that you need to decide if chiropractors with training should or should not be working on animals. There will be, in the future, if Minnesota is typical of all the other states, there will be scope of practice issues coming down the line with regard to veterinary medicine, mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's something that you need to prepare for. This is not a fly-by-night, some aberration of legislation, and it's going to go away. But things like this are going to be coming. This is not to discuss what the legal status of animals is. That's not a debate point, and it's not, and it should not change. They are chattel. However, animals, unlike your car, which is property, there are laws for protection for beating your animals or inhumane care of your animals where there isn't of cars. So there is a slight difference, although they certainly do not have the status of people. As far as the Chiropractic Practice Act and the Physical Therapy Practice Act, it says specifically within them that licensees can only work on animals or only work on people. So licensed chiropractors, Senator Johnson, licensed physical therapists that are working on animals are doing so illegally, violating their practice act. So part of this is removing the human from the Chiropractic Practice Act. And that's an important point because the only accountable individual that has training is the veterinarian at this point in time. Each year there are licensed chiropractors that are disciplined for practicing on animals illegally. They don't lose their license, but there is a correction, and that it is not legal as of this point. Regarding Senator Hahn's questions as far as, well, can my neighbor work on my animals? And the answer is likely not to a point. The statutes 156.12 define the practice of veterinary medicine. And although you may choose to have a neighbor that may or may not be qualified to work in your animal, there's no one that's accountable. There's no one's trained. And the important thing is that individuals that provide services to animals, not just that the consumer has a choice, but they have a choice from a pool of individuals that have training and accountability. And that's where the rubber meets the road. Yes, they are property, but when bad things happen, someone wants to be able to say, this person needs to stop doing what they're doing. There will likely be some fiscal impact to the Cairo board and or to the veterinary board in the rule writing process. The chiropractic board is going to have to obtain somehow expertise in evaluating standard of care for human chiropractors working on animals. So there are some issues that haven't really been addressed, but it's really about a scope of practice issue for chiropractors, this bill.
Senator Johnson, then I think we're ready to make decisions here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the second veterinarian, he made some outstanding points, and I think something that we're going to see here, if this does pass, insurance underwriters are going to go nuts trying to figure out how to cover this stuff.
Further discussion, if not, Senator Coring moves Senate File 3165 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one comment to committee members, if I may. You know, earlier in this committee, we moved out of this committee a bill for advanced dental hygiene practice, which allowed hygienists with a little bit more treatment training to treat human patients in a manner that a dentist would. We're spending more time and more concern on this bill for animals than we did on that one for humans with their teeth. I think we've lost our way a little bit.
I can go for that.
Further discussion, if not on the Coring motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Coring, we're going to try and move quickly through yours and mine, too, because there are witnesses who are not likely to be here
so
tonight.
So we're not doing Lori's optometrist?
Or self-smith.
Have fun tonight. I can't be here. I'd be happy to send a check.
Senator Coring, sent file 2368.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You have a delete everything amendment that's being handed out, I understand.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do. Mr. Chairman, before we do the, or you don't want, maybe I should just, do we need to even explain why I'm changing it, or do you just want me to explain?
That's your choice, Senator Coring. You may explain.
Well, let's just do the delete all amendment. I would, Mr. Chairman, I would offer the A1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that I'd like to have it.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I do want to make another amendment to the amendment. I guess I should have incorporated that. On line 1.5, after a cross out within, on the very end, within, and put in no later than 120 days.
Senator Coring moves on line 5 to strike within and insert no later than.
That makes sense.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have Mr. Tesner kind of explain why this bill got prompted by my House member, and, of course, I'm carrying it here on the Senate side.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Tesner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tesner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services. We operate both the state hospitals as well as the enterprise activities that are of concern in this bill. Enterprise activities, I want to give a little background to understand the context of this. The enterprise activities were created in the early 90s by action of the legislature, essentially allowing the Commissioner of Human Services to establish services for people with mental retardation, chemical dependency, traumatic brain injury, child and adolescent mental health services on the enterprise side, which means that there are funding sources available to the individual that fully fund the care. So these services operate much like a private business would. People come in, they're eligible for some type of a benefit. That benefit essentially covers all the costs of those services. That was put in place at a time when the downsizing of the regional centers was going on. It allowed great flexibility in the development of new and innovative services, and it's been ongoing since that time. At present, we have about 200 group homes all over the state serving people with mental retardation, mental illness, traumatic brain injury. We have 20-day training and habilitation programs all over the state serving people who are in need of vocational training. We operate 6 chemical dependency programs that are located throughout the state, a child and adolescent hospital in Willmar, and a neurorehab hospital in Brainerd. This issue became came to the attention of Representative Ward and Senator Coring after we were forced to close one of the child and adolescent hospitals. Over the last 4 years, the utilization of the 2 hospitals that serve child and adolescents, both one at Willmar and at Brainerd, suffered a downturn in utilization. These are acute inpatient hospitals serving kids that need acute inpatient mental health services, and essentially what was going on is we were seeing fewer people come to our door. Fewer people coming to the door means reduced revenues. Reduced revenues have to be managed because we're operating on the enterprise side. We did a number of things throughout the last 4 years to manage the downturn in revenues. We changed staffing schedules. We changed the numbers of staff. We shrank the number of beds available to match and available and staff to match the need of the patient population coming in. This past early this year, we had to make the decision to consolidate those 2 hospitals into a single hospital at Willmar, which effectively closed the Brainerd Hospital. What this bill allows us to do is to ensure that we maintain the flexibility of the enterprise activities so that we are still responsive to the marketplace, but it also requires us to communicate better with the legislature in advance of any decision to close or to transfer programs.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just speak on that a little bit. The Child Adolescent Behavioral Health Services was closed in Brainerd. And the bill that I was originally carrying, most members know I'm when the department weighs in, I'm not a big fan of that, but I will say that Mr. Tesner did weigh in and did convince me that the language that I did originally have was just not workable. If, let's just say, for example, they were going to close it on May 29th and we were already out of session and it needed legislative approval, they couldn't get rid of those people, if I'm mistaken, until we come back into session and get legislative approval. So what I did do is just change the amendment so that at least, and I think Mr. Tesner will say that they wish they would have informed the legislators, correct? And so what this does is just say that they have to, if they're going to do this, they have to inform the chair of the Health Policy Committee and the chair of the Budget Division and the ranking minority members on both of those committees. And we've got McAfee from AFSCME that would like to speak to this too.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Mark McAfee representing AFSCME Council 5. We have we represent a number of employees in DHS. And this bill it's not about the fact that we will have changes in movement to the community, but it was more the fact that this CABS program that was located up in Brainerd, we knew there were issues with it, but for whatever reasons, the decision to finally close it and then move what remained of it to Willmar. Our folks received official notice on February 1st, and I believe that's about when the legislators received notice as well. And I think, obviously, as it was stated, perhaps this original language makes it a bit unworkable, takes away flexibility, but I think it will... will be better for everyone, given the fact that in this session, for example, you have to make some very tough budget choices, and I think the 120 days seem reasonable. Mr. Tesner suggested that, so that if we're going to make a change, we're going to close or we're going to relocate a program, that the committee chairs and the ranking minority member get notice, legislators will be informed, Also, it gives a little longer time frame, you know, for us. So that's really, I think, why the bill came forward and came through the House originally, was this bit of a reaction that, gee, this was just, even though there are issues, it was just kind of dropped on us. So I think this is a reasonable compromise to have this amendment. So thank you.
Questions from the committee. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Klein, frankly, I'm a little disappointed that the department, or that, I don't know, that we feel that we need to have statutory language that in essence says the legislature and the department need to communicate with one another, and we want to be apprised of what's happening related pertinent to the citizens of Minnesota.
Senator Corrin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more with Senator Lynch. I don't know if Mr.
Well, he didn't ask for it. We did. Huh? Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, yes, I think we do need better communications, and the department did not ask for this. It came more from legislators, also concerned from AFSCME. We certainly need more advanced, better communications, but I think I think that it's reasonable to have this, since we haven't always had that.
Senator Coring moves his.
No, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coring, and members, frankly, I'm concerned about the precedent that this might establish. So that if I have a statute, if I don't have statutory language that addresses something else, that some other action that the department may or may not take, does that mean that I don't need that communication, or it's not an expectation? I mean, think of what that might look like. This is a very sad state of affairs if we have come to this point. Our problems are much larger than this bill, if this is what it takes in order that that happen.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, and believe me, I'm not getting after Mr. Tesner, because I have a great working relationship, but this goes back to what I've been telling members all along. I'm asking the members of the Minnesota Senate, who are the policymakers? It is us. We have the election certificates. We set forth the policy, the department's carried out. We need to have better communication so that they know what we know what they're doing, because it's their job to communicate with us, I think. And so it points to what I've been saying all along. And so this bill that I originally had, I agree with Mr. Tesner. It was just unworkable. It just doesn't make sense. AFSCME agrees with it. And I think, and I agree with Senator Lynch, but I'm just trying to say the department, you know, you got to inform us if you're going to make some huge changes. So I whatever the will of the committee is fine with me. I would point out that I did run this by Senator Berglund. She's not here. Senator Berglund said she has no problem with it. So
Senator Coring moves Senate File 2368 as amended, be recommended pass. Discussion. Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We're going to very quickly.
Thank you.
We don't lose the room, but I'm going to try and at least get the testimony in my two buildings. Don't there are people who are out of town. But I'm going to try not to go very long on this. Senate file.
Senator Marty, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senate file 3353 is a COLA bill. And it's a cost of living adjustment for long-term care. I recognize most of the decision of this bill is going to be done in Senator Berglund's division, and we also recognize it will not be an easy sell this year. However, we do a couple of things that we want to make sure we at least we're pushing for a cost of living adjustment, because I think we all recognize all of our nursing facilities, ICFMRs, everything, are really struggling to make ends meet. And this would give them an across-the-board increase. Would also change the rebasing system. This is put together, this bill is put together by workers, people who work in nursing homes, and seniors, the Seniors and Workers for Quality group, which has come up with a bill the last couple of years. And we'd like to speed up the rebasing. We'd like to switch it. The governor has proposed scrapping the rebasing system. We're trying to push that forward. This bill also tries to address health care for long-term workers. The Healthcare Access Commission, which we thought was going to at least move for that, ended up appropriating, I think it's $800,000 for a study of that. This would try and, by a temporary rate increase, would help people afford insurance. And I believe we also have a provision in here that would make it so somebody who you would have access to MinCare, even if your employer has this thing, if it's unaffordable for you. And then finally, we make some changing in terminology for staffing to make it consistent across the board. And have Iris Freeman here who can speak to more detail to any of those provisions.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Go ahead, Ms. Freeman.
Under many other circumstances, I would thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Iris Freeman. I'm here for Seniors and Workers for Quality, which includes AARP, the Alzheimer's Association, Elder Care Rights Alliance, the League of Women Voters, the Adult Day Services Association, the Nurses Association, Social Workers, and the Union Coalition of Long-Term Care Workers. This is an initiative of all of these organizations. The time does not exist. The conditions are grave. It is about better care and better jobs, and I hope that today we'll see this bill be re-referred to the Finance Committee for that work.
Thank you. Ms. Freeman, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mike Dreyer, and I work with United Food and Commercial Workers Local 789, and I represent approximately 3,000 members that we have in long-term care. I worked in the industry myself for 30 years. I was a nursing assistant, an orderly. I worked in the maintenance department. I have a new hat today. I now represent these workers. Many of these workers are making difficult choices. Many are single parents. Many are trying to provide health care, put food on their table and a roof over their head. Some are working two and three jobs to provide for their families. I'm here today asking you to support this bill and to give a livable wages and benefits to these workers who care for our seniors, our parents, our grandparents, who deserve the very best care possible. However, we talk about these same issues year after year and still have no way to get these caregivers ahead without your help. You can ask how we pay for this. Do we cut aid from other deserving programs? Sometimes cheap is expensive. Failing to properly staff and reward our hands-on caregivers is costly to the system in workers' injuries, resident injuries, and preventable hospitalizations. Not spending money isn't the same as saving money. Finally, I know that everyone on the legislative committees has shown concern for the plight of these hardworking caregivers. This is why I'm here today representing them and asking for your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dreyer.
And Madam Chair, the very brief time we have here for the bill, you guys, the importance of the bill, I really think we have to recognize we've got a crisis in terms of the compensation for long-term care employees. That's why it's interesting that we've got a senior citizen coalition working with the employees to try and find ways to address this issue. Have Charlie Oakes from Wilmer?
That's me.
Go ahead, Mr. Oakes.
Thank you. I'm the executive director of West Central Industries in Wilmer and Hutchinson, and we operate a day training and habilitation center, one of the over 200 private nonprofit day training and habilitation centers in the state of Minnesota. And since 2003, we have fallen behind the rate of inflation somewhere between 8% and 9%. Currently, our understanding is that the supplemental budget proposal by the governor would freeze us for another year and a half. It's hard for me to attract employees. It's hard for me to keep employees. About half of my employees have second jobs. About half of my employees and their families qualify for Minnesota Care. I think the work we do is important. I think it's one of the ways that we measure our civilization and our humanity. And I think that as someone who's been in this business since 30 years ago at the Faribault and Wilma Regional Treatment Centers, where my wife and I were psych techs, I think it's evolved, and I think that we're doing a good job for people, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult when starting wages are no better than what you get for selling hamburgers at one of the franchises on the main drag. Long-term care deserves to have good people that can afford to pay their bills in its employ. So I appreciate Senator Marty's support for this. I was sitting back here listening to the previous bill, and it occurred to me that what they're talking about is important for the 20-day training and rehabilitation programs that the state of Minnesota operates. A similar protection would be nice for the 200 independent nonprofit programs that have to make decisions about whether they're going to stay in business or not, too. And we don't have any oversight from this committee when those calamities occur that I'm aware of. Yes, this would go. This would be very helpful as far as helping us retain the staff that we have, and it does not go far enough to create, to make us whole for the last 5 years, but it would be very generous from your committee during very difficult financial times, and we would be grateful to receive it.
Thank you, Mr. Oaks. Senator Marty, your next witness.
Yes, Mr. Nelson.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Nelson,
members of the members of the committee, I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM. We represent about 150 providers who support people with disabilities in ICFMR and the various waivers, and employ about 30,000 long-term care workers or direct support professionals. I'll be very brief, and I'm here today really not to talk so much about providers and our heating bills and whatnot go up, but people. First and foremost, people with disabilities. Without staff paid adequately, you have a turnstile with a high turnover, and quality and very safety and health of people are very much in jeopardy. And the direct support professionals are long-term care workers who over the last 5 years have seen an increase of 5.6% relative to inflation of about 15%. It's most difficult for them to even pay for their very most basic needs like groceries and gas at the pump. So as you make the hard decisions ahead, I urge you to consider the elderly, people with disabilities, direct support professionals, nursing home workers, PCAs, and all those in Senator Marty's bill. And thank you very much for carrying the bill. And I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Marty, the staff has handed me the A2
amendment. A2 technical
amendment.
Yeah, I'd like to move that.
Senator Marty moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, obviously most of these decisions have to be made in the budget division. I do think we're not giving a lot of time to this now because of the nature of our schedule here. But I think we've got to focus on the fact we're not doing adequately for people who work with our most vulnerable citizens. I've always thought that the people who work most directly with other human beings who are vulnerable are the ones we should be paying more to, not less to. And I think this is critically important, and I urge the committee's support, but happy to stand for any questions about any parts of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Staff just indicated that perhaps Mr. Lips or Ms. Meyer would like to still make a short comment.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Ms. Yes. Meyer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Meyer, Senior Vice President with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, and with me today is John Lips, who is Vice President of Advocacy for Care Providers of Minnesota. Together, we represent the Long-Term Care Imperative. We want to speak briefly to four elements of the bill today, Senate File 3353. The first relates to the COLA. We strongly support the bill's call for a 5% increase in rates in 2008. which first and foremost recognizes the importance of providing a much-deserved wage increase to the caregivers in long-term care settings. You've already heard others testify as to the need of this COLA, so please include our voices in the chorus of those calling for a COLA increase this session. Secondly, I do want to point out the importance of the provision in the bill that provides a rate increase for health insurance costs. It is a goal that the long-term care imperative shares with the advocates for this bill. It's really important that we increase access to health insurance for the employees of long-term care. Our provider members are spending more each year to provide worse coverage to fewer employees. That is a trend that we must reverse if we are to attract and retain the important caregivers in long-term care settings. As you've heard, there has been a Healthcare Access Commission work group convened to study this very topic. And through their efforts, a number of key questions have been raised as to how this might occur. And we support the study language in this bill that the commission recommends to gather data and advance this in the future. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Lips.
Mr. Lips, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. John Lips with Care Providers of Minnesota. Just two really brief points to finish. Senator Marty described a portion of the bill that seeks to study the consistency of terminology with respect to staffing, and we just wanted to say for the record we'd be very pleased to participate in any discussions about that. And then also, and this is an issue that clearly will be debated and decided by the Finance Committee, but the bill also proposes to freeze the implementation of rebasing. I think when you take the bill altogether, it would be sort of for 1 year while some additional study of the rebasing language is undertaken, and from there to phase it in over a shorter time frame. We ourselves also feel that there are some problems with the rebasing language. There are issues, many of which may need to be dealt with in 2009, but we favor, as we sit here today, we favor beginning the implementation of rebasing in 2008. In an incremental fashion with some floor and ceiling adjustments that we've proposed to make sure that facilities at least receive a minimum increase under that. But it's a policy issue that can be debated another day in the Finance Committee, so appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lips and Ms. Meyer. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the Finance Committee, but I'm happy to stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty. Senator Marty, earlier this session, I think it was this session, we had some discussions or there were some comments generated, and I'm speaking very generally, by the long-term care community about some suggestions that they had. Does this bill, in your mind, is this a accumulation of those concerns? Or is maybe that's in another bill that I haven't seen?
Senator Marty. Or Ms. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, Iris Freeman. I'm not certain that I know the reference that you were making. What I can say is that this is a buffet. It is a compilation of those key issues as we see them in long-term care. The adequacy of the rates, the fact that rates do not meet the current costs of care, the fact that health insurance is not affordable or available to long-term care workers, and that we have a growing need.
Senator Lynch.
Chair and Senator Marty, part of the reason I asked the question is I can't help but noticing this room is quite vacant this afternoon when we're having this discussion. And it's an inference made that by implementing this legislation and supporting the initiatives, that that's an indication of the priority that we might be giving to this particular issue. And I would just point out that last session we utilized more than 50% of our new allocation in the area of long-term care. And I think that there are many members that felt that maybe we even wish that we could have been in a position to do more, frankly. But this is such a huge part of the overall equation. So it does surprise me that for something that is such a large part of our budget and has been such an ongoing long-term issue, it makes me wonder if this is the covers it all or not. I'm a little unclear. But Senator Marty, if I could, with regard to Section 11 on rebasing and Section 12, the report on staffing, I think those are both good things, good conversations that need to happen. And I would just offer that I would hope, with or without statutory language, that that conversation and that work would be done with or without this bill. Madam Chair, that's all.
Thank you, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
Senator Lynch, I strongly agree, and I think, yes, this is asking the commissioners and so on to work with people, which I think we all want to have happen. And as you mentioned about the money, which is, again, the biggest part of this bill, and we recognize the time, I think it's important just to keep reminding us that even though this is getting a big portion of it and we have other desperate needs, that this is a very, very serious problem. And I think the advocates are coming in knowing it's not likely to happen, but thinking it's very important to say it, that we need it. I don't disagree with you on what you're saying.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, your point on the vacancy of the room, a couple weeks ago, right above us, there was a packed house of those who are concerned about this very issue. And most of those people probably are out working right now with their the folks with the disabilities and the nursing homes and can't frankly afford maybe to come here and advocate. So I know we maybe could have a few more here, but I think it's, you know, this is the reason that we're dealing with this here, is that this is a tragedy, and it's only going to get worse. And as we get more and more people that are getting to that age of retirement or needing nursing care services, we're losing the people that are supposed to be providing the services. And if we don't address this some way, somehow, we're going to have a second crisis on our hands. And I know that the budget is a big part of this, but I'm hoping that we can somehow get really creative and figure out a way to provide some money for these folks.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Senator Marty, you've moved your bill, and we're in discussion. And I just want to add a little bit of an echo to what's been said. The brevity of the time that we have to discuss this bill just undermines how important it is. In outstate and small communities, these nursing homes are near and dear to our hearts. They're grandpa and grandma. My case, mom. And so... And they're hurting. They're hurting really bad. A nurse in a long-term care facility where I live earns probably $7 an hour or more, less than a nurse in the hospital that's less than a half a mile away and takes care of our vulnerable seniors. I would like more than anything probably to see this problem solved. And I will very much go on record as saying to freeze the nursing home rates is not one of the things I want to see as part of the budget solution. With that, any other discussion on Senator Marty's motion? Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Senator Marty, were we going to do any other business?
I had one more, and I don't know if one of the witnesses is from out of town. If I could have at least the testimony of the witness from uptown on Senate File 3030.
Senator Marty, then we'll take a look at Senate File 3030 and handle it as you wish.
And Madam Chair, while the witnesses are coming up, this bill is an attempt to get a statewide toll-free telephone number for mental health crises. We have 911, but that's not who you want to have come out when there's a person with mental health crisis. That means they call the police. That may not be the ones you have. We're growing quality of crisis care services available for people with mental illness, and we need to have a way when there's a crisis that occurs to connect the crisis with the intervention folks. And we want to have a look at feasibility of having a statewide 311 or 511 type of number.
Thank you, Senator Marty. And Senator Marty, I've been handed the A1 amendment, which I assume is your author's
That's correct. A technical amendment to the bill.
Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Marty, do you want to call your first witness?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Parnell, and I live in Matamidi in Washington County. My son, Raul, is here with me today, and I am grateful to him for allowing me to share our story with you. His issues include a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, and he has a co-occurring chemical addiction. Drugs he's used have inhibited the effectiveness of prescription medications, and we've been for about 4 years trying to determine the right ones to control visual and audio hallucinations and mood instability. During that time, I've become a volunteer and advocate in the field of mental illness and trying to learn as much as I can about the disease and our systems of care. I have learned that our situation is shared by many others, and my own family's experiences have included a lot of things that are shared from those families. In terms of emergencies, that includes raw nerves and fear, indecision, concerns for physical safety of my son, the family, others in the community. The moments of crisis that we've had are the ones that magnify the negative aspects of the mental illness, and it really tests any who respond to use their best skills and judgment. Most often they're beyond the abilities of well-meaning parents or close friends, and increasingly, tragically, the best efforts of police officers. On many of these calls, it's been a hurried call to a crisis line individual who's desk-bound. They're unable to respond physically or certainly not in the time frame that would be needed. I remember it was troublesome to determine what crisis number to use based on the day of the week, the time of the day, whether it was involving my son as a child or an adult. Ultimately, in most of those situations, it resulted in a call to the police to locate Raul out in the community or to assist in transporting him to a hospital. Our history with crisis includes threats that my son would end his life, threats that he would harm others, and situations where I feared that his lack of ability to make rational judgments could result in him being jailed or restrained, or in that attempt that he would escalate police response to something I'm afraid to even consider. Again, these experiences are pretty typical from countless discussions I've had with other families. A simple example story might point it out, and it involves a little irony. It happened a little over a month ago. Raul has lived in a group home for about a year, and it's helped foster his independence and living skills and enabled our relationship to grow into something more than one characterized by restrictions and authoritarian rule. In recent months, he had abused a small stipend that he has, and we had agreed that after an allotment, we would withhold some of that money to make sure he wouldn't be spending it on drugs. On the day that I'm talking about, I had taken the day off work to attend the Minnesota Mental Health Innovations Conference crosstown in Brooklyn Center. One of the sessions of particular interest to me was the presentation by Roger Meyer, who is the coordinator of Metro Mobile Crisis Services. He included in his discussion his hope that we could have a single first call for help phone number for mental health crisis. At the conclusion of the session, I found I had two voicemail messages on my machine. I could recognize them immediately as the resident line and the business line of the home where my son lives. So sensing distress, I called them immediately. The first was my son, and he was agitated to the point of expletives in his displeasure that his money wasn't made available to him. The second was the manager of the group home, who gave me her perspective on the event, and it included her sense of fear for both her own personal safety and his. His threats included harm to himself. His mood was psychotic. He ended up storming out of the place, and we didn't know where he was going. I had just come from a session that was related to crisis management, and the reality was that the system wasn't prepared to deal with the situation that I had in front of me. If I were to call the crisis number, they might be able to completely understand what I needed but be unable to respond. And if I were to call the police, I'd reach people who could react really quickly. But without the needed context, you know, in fact, their presence might actually escalate the situation. During those moments when the rationality goes out the window is when families really face the challenge. And thankfully, this situation resolved itself in Raul's return to judgment. And as he walked the streets of Stillwater, he kind of came to his senses and it de-escalated. I'm pleased to report that he recently completed a month-long dual diagnosis treatment and he's committed to sobriety. But what we need is a crisis intervention team that would respond to incidents such as this one with a team that's trained and available. What we would need is for that team to be available at whatever telephone number was used for an emergency, be it 911 or a different number like 811. What would be best is for law enforcement and 911 operators and families in crisis to be able to reach a crisis team fluidly and seamlessly so that the number isn't important, except that triage can transfer something there. A mental health emergency could occur on a crowded highway in a place where jurisdiction is questionable and from a random caller who has no knowledge of a specific mental illness crisis line. Those medical emergencies happen every day, and we're able to respond with prompt medical care. We need the same response to answer the needs of those with mental illness emergencies. I'm not naive enough to think it can happen immediately. There's probably not the structure to do it within the system today, but we need to pull those people together who know how crisis services are provided within the state, from law enforcement, public service agencies, and those who understand 911. Together, these people should be able to figure out how we can accomplish an easier way to access mental health crisis services. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Parnell.
Madam Chair, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. Just very quickly, you know, last year you appropriated a lot of money to help, you know, really develop our crisis services. This is the listing from the Department of Human Services website of all the different numbers you could call in the state. Clearly, if you're in an emergency, even if you live in Freeborn County, you're going to have to figure out which of the four phone numbers you could call. So while we're at the beginning stages, now is the time to figure out, can we do just one phone number, or at least two, or, you know, one in the metro, one out, I don't know. But now is the time to do it, not 5 years from now. So we think it's really important to pass.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Mr. Doyle.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, briefly, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and I was also a 15-year paramedic. And so from a moral and also a very practical standpoint, we in the ambulance industry very strongly support creation of such a line. I've been on mental health crisis calls. It's frightening for the patient. It's frightening for our providers. If there was a more centralized means of accessing help and crisis teams, I think that it would be better for everyone involved. Remember, we wear uniforms, and a lot of time people in crisis can't distinguish between a police officer or a paramedic. And we just think this is an excellent idea, and I'm proud to say we're going to be working with NAMI on increased training for our paramedics and EMTs on dealing with mental health crises, and volunteering our time, whatever we can do to help make this a reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm going to move the bill. I learned a little while ago that this bill also has to go to State GOCO, which I should have figured out, and obviously it won't meet deadline there. It may be added to some other bill, and we're going to be working with the department, asking them to do it, regardless of whether there's legislation or not. So I will move the bill, be recommended pass, and referred to the Committee on State and Local.
So thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Berglund, you have something?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just wondered if the department thinks they'll be placing a fiscal note on this bill.
Fiscal note.
No. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Marty has moved that Senate File 3030 be moved to the state and recommended to pass and go to State and Local Government Committee. Any discussion from the committee? Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, could you recess until 6 o'clock? Then
The Health and Human Services Committee is recessed until 6 o'clock, and we'll be back in room G15. Thank you.